Welcome back to the third and final hour of Issues Etc. Two guests during this hour. We're going to be spending some time talking with Bishop Harry Jackson. The Black Contract with America on Moral Values is our subject for the first 10 minutes or so. I'll open up the phone lines after that. I'd like the reaction of all of our listeners, but especially our Black listeners, on the Black Contract with America on Moral Values for a few minutes. Then, 25 minutes out, we're going to be talking with Dr. James Hitchcock from St. Louis University. A new Vatican statement on marriage annulments will be the subject. We will also entertain the question about the Pope's, well, not only his health, but also the prospect for the rest of the papacy. We'll be talking about whether or not he ought to step down. Dr. James Hitchcock, professor of history at St. Louis University, will be our guest in about 25 minutes on Issues Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I was surprised to read about this, and probably surprised because I thought that the contract with America were a thing of the past. But what was a good idea the first time? Perhaps a good idea the second time, too. We're going to talk about the Black Contract with America on moral values. Bishop Harry Jackson is our guest. He's chairman of the High Impact Coalition, the organization that released the Black Contract with America. Bishop Jackson, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hey, Todd. Thank you so much for having me.
Happy to do it. What is the need for the Black Contract with America?
Well, historically, the Black community has voted justice issues. Some people would call them pocketbook issues, but really they've been biblical justice issues. After the last election, we saw that many African-American leaders began to move more in step with the broader Christian community. Our hope is that as we create this Black Contract with America on moral values, that what we'll do is have many of our Black people look at a moral basis for our votes, our decisions, our political support based on the Bible, and that we'll rally other Christians who are Hispanic, white, etc., to come alongside and let's change America while we've got this window of opportunity during the Bush administration.
Let's talk about that window of opportunity. I think everyone of us, reflecting upon the November elections, saw that the window was not just a crack open, but wide open for the issue of moral values to enter the political conversation. Is that part of the impetus for the Black Contract with America as well?
Well, it certainly is. Todd, I wrote a book with a guy named George Barna, who many of your listeners may know of,
sure,
called High Impact African American Churches. Came out last summer. And I noticed, along with George, that Black pastors are especially motivated to see political involvement as an extension of their faith. And I went on a lot of shows. I was on O'Reilly, CBS Evening News. I did about 50 interviews right before the end of the election coming out pro-George Bush. And I found that there was a movement in Florida, in Ohio, those swing states, really the incremental Black vote won the election in Ohio for the president. But what I've noticed was that many Blacks said, well, you know, we're voting against same-sex marriage, and we're voting for prohibition of abortion in its great proliferation, even in the Black community. But we think that there's still a gap in terms of justice. And so what this contract deals with, there's six very, very simple points. We deal with family reconstruction issues. We'll talk more about that later. Wealth creation, educational reform. We deal with an African relief issue in terms of the Sudan. Things have been done there non-militarily that are very important. We talk about prison reform. One out of every three Black adult male has been involved with the criminal justice system in our day. It's really an atrocious thing. And finally, we talk about health care reform that deals with those who are among the least of these economically. And I began to think about this and began to talk with people around the country about it. Every place that I've gone and preached about these things, for example, folks have said, yeah, we want an America that has more opportunity for Blacks and whites. And I believe that this is really simply a social justice addendum, if you would, to what the Republican Party has said it wants to do morally in this next term.
Let's take each one of these points in turn. Family reconstruction, what's meant by that?
Well, when I talk about family reconstruction, I want you to think about the fact that we not only want to be anti-abortion and anti-gay same-sex marriage, but we want to think about the fact that in the black community, the foster care system is just out of control, along with the fact that there needs to be some restraints lifted from churches being able to have adoption agencies, things of that nature that will allow there to be homes for black children. Right now, if you're a black child, people may go all the way overseas and find a kid to adopt, but they're not likely to adopt you. This is not a problem that I'm going to call simply a black problem. It is an American societal problem. So we want to do something about that, and we want to make a difference. I think this is very, very important for us.
And wealth creation.
Wealth creation has to do with the issue of poverty. The Bible talks a lot about the fact that true religion and undefiled is to care for widows and orphans. And so what we do in our contract, we talk about several things. Under the Bush administration, the first term, home ownership among minorities, blacks specifically, went from 50 to 52%. It's still about 20% below the mainstream American numbers. Further, we need to target in some of these urban cities or urban environments, instead of the gentrification, you know, where wealthy people move back in, raise the rates, send out the poor people, we need to target some of our communities and to make sure that there's an opportunity for businesses to grow and develop. I think that even the president's Social Security plan to privatize Social Security and let some of the funds be generationally passed on are wonderful. Now, for the record, let me say I am not on the payroll of the Republican Party. I'm a registered Democrat, actually, but I was pro-Bush. I'm going for this thing, and I'm simply trying to be a broker between my community and the greater Christian community and the politicians to say, let's make a difference.
On educational reform, what is envisioned by the Black Contract with America?
Well, there, what we're saying is there's been a lot of rhetoric that needs to have some teeth to it. And what I mean by that is No Child Left Behind. All over the nation, there have been pictures of little black kids, and you have vouchers that are talked about and all kind of reform. We need to start, Todd, right now in urban areas. In Baltimore, Washington region, we have in some segments 50% dropout rates of black kids from high school. If we don't do something about those kids now, they're going to be an internal terroristic group that's going to hold these cities hostage at gunpoint. We've got to make a difference there.
Now, you had mentioned also in particular one country that is in need of a plan for relief, the Sudan, I believe?
Yes. There we're talking about non-military intervention. That's similar to what happened with South Africa in years gone by, how that external tariffs made a major difference in the internal operation of the country, brought them to a point where they were willing to make major changes and reform. And we haven't really been doing that much. I think President Bush has done a lot with his AIDS initiative worldwide. I think that's admirable. I think that he, more than other presidents, has even censured some of the African leaders who've been kind of out of control. And, you know, despotic rule of leadership is a major problem in Africa. But we're simply saying take it another step and make a difference there.
Folks, in about 5 minutes, we'll finish our interview with Bishop Jackson, and then we'll open up the phone lines for your thoughts on the Black Contract with America on moral values. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'd especially like to hear from some of our black listeners, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Pause briefly here before we go on to those last two points. Yesterday, I was reading something from a listener. He had written in a local publication. From a Democratic perspective, he said, look, the window was opened to moral values, and speaking as a Democrat, he said, we need to recapture the moral values and the concerns that we ought to have. Is this the spirit, in effect, of the black contract with America on moral values? He was a black male writing this.
Yeah, Todd, you really hit it, because I've been on so many interviews, it's been amazing, but I was on a program with Rabbi Michael Lerner, who is considered by many on the left, and at the end of a week-long discussion with all these people, he said, we need the black church to make a difference and to kind of show us the way morally. And that's the same thing that the person you're reading about said. And I think that even the NAE, in a meeting with Ted Haggard, the president of the NAE, he's basically saying the same thing, that the African Americans have got to lead the church in discussion of some of the historic justice issues of our day, just as they did in the Civil Rights Movement. And the reason the gay community has tried to hijack the Civil Rights Movement and say, we're just like the Civil Rights Movement, is because that morally based movement was the most persuasive and powerful attempt of a grassroots group of people to change the way America thinks about society and what they're doing with their lives. And the Civil Rights Movement pricked the conscience of America. And it really wasn't just the legislation under Johnson, but it was actually the consciences that were pricked by the nonviolent approach of Dr. King. And you're right, we need that kind of moral definition, and it can't be that blacks are over on one side and they're, you know, our leaders are saying, well, abortion is not that big a problem, and, well, you know, same-sex marriage is not that big a problem. We have these other issues. There's got to be a holistic, consistent, biblically-based approach.
Prison reform, this is one that perhaps people on all sides of the political spectrum can say there's something that must be done when we have a disproportionately large percentage of the population in prison being black male.
We've got to handle it. I mean, Todd, if you think about not only black males, also Hispanic community, I think would resonate with this need. There are two issues. One is, how do we prevent the problem? We could have a whole show on that. And then the other issue, because someone would say it's better to put a rail at the top of the hill than it is to have an ambulance at the bottom of a hill. But once people who get involved in the prison system, the stats show that 84% of these guys commit crimes under the influence of drugs or alcohol. You get them in a system where they're coached at how to be worse. Some of them are brutalized, raped, etc., in prison. Then when they go out, no wonder they become even worse than they were before. So there are a lot of people, you know, the Prison Fellowship, Chuck Colson's group, who are advocating aftercare programs. There's a bill in Congress now, I believe it should be something that's it's been worked on, should be passed this year if we all get behind it. There's a thing called a Second Chance Act. And Portman in the Congress and in the Senate, you have Brownback, who are supporting making it easier for people to reenter to society. So there's legislative things that need to be done, because sometimes you lose your driver's license. Can you imagine trying to get a job and you can't drive a car? You can't vote. There are all kind of issues that are pursuant to having been involved in the criminal justice system. Some young black kids with the three strikes you're out kind of legislation, you'll find that these kids start a life of crime in early age before they know what they're doing, and by 30 they might be locked away, never to see the light of day again, perpetuating what I'm going to call a generational cycle of poverty and incarceration. We need to do something.
And finally, of the points, health care reform. What's envisioned there by the Black Contract with America?
Well, the big thing, remember, all these points is we're casting vision. I'm talking with a lot of people so that we can create a bipartisan group, and I'm going for 1 million people to sign up. I'm going to give you a website a little later to sign up at our website and to say, I may be white, I may be black, I want to make a difference. With healthcare, the big thing that we deal with is simply the economic disparity in access to adequate healthcare. And on a top-line basis, I'll simply say it's no secret that of your top five killers of all Americans, whatever rate you have there, you'll find that black adult victims of these cancers, high blood pressures, diabetes, et cetera, are there more black people falling to these things. And so we need to detect their illnesses early, treat them, and therefore they need some kind of health care plan for needy people.
Two quick final questions. Yes. Have you noticed an increasing number of black conservatives who are pro-life and anti-gay marriage, anti-homosexual?
Well, I have. I mean, in writing the book with George Barna, what we found is that the baby boomer, the youngest baby boomers and under, you're going to find a lot of word-oriented evangelical preachers who are in that category. Now, they are a leadership group that is now going to affect the rest of the black community. So it is growing. And our movement, though grassroots, we're trying to get everybody to sign up, white, black, green, whatever, so to speak. We also, in our summits as we go around the country, are targeting dialogues with black clergy because they are significant change agents and power brokers, if you would, that can increase this trend that I'm seeing around the country.
Have you received any negative reaction to the black contract with America?
Yes.
What has it been like?
Well, I mean, first of all, we've gotten a lot of great articles, but the Los Angeles Times did a front page story on us last week. Right after that, people showed up in our meetings who were openly lesbian or whatever, and instead of listening to these 6 points, they stop at the fact that you've got to have this even-handed moral issue of marriage, protecting marriage culturally, and they go, oh, you're a bigot, you're this, you're that. And based on our stance on marriage, many of the folks are basically saying, well, you're a Republican Party pawn, and you're this, you're that. So we've gotten a lot of news, but I'd say two-thirds of it is very, very positive, and a third, though, tends to be guys that are taking shots at us and saying, we don't believe that you're really going to keep talking about the other 5 points. We think you're just some stealth group trying to push the president's issues about same-sex marriage, a constitutional amendment.
And finally, how can our listeners find out more about the Black Contract with America on Moral Values? How can they find out more?
Well, the easy way to find out more will be for you to, forgive the background noise, look on our website, www.hempact, stands for High Impact, HIMPACTUS.com, www.HIMPACTUS.com, and there you can sign up and you will see the points listed out. You'll see articles. I've written a lot of national articles, have been in papers all over the United States during the last year, and it will be a great place for information for pastors as well as for lay people to say, look, we want to make a difference. Make that difference by signing up with us.
Bishop Harry Jackson is chairman of the High Impact Coalition, the organization that released the Black Contract with America on Moral Values. Bishop Jackson, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd, very much for having us.
That website address again is himpactus.com, himpactus.com. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Your reaction to the Black Contract with America on Moral Values. We've discussed it with Bishop Jackson. I'd like your thoughts on it as well. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In about 10 minutes, we'll be talking with Dr. James Hitchcock of St. Louis University about the Vatican's new statement on annulments and should the Pope step down. That's coming up in about 5 minutes. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, while we wait for your phone calls, have you seen the movie Clint Eastwood directs and stars in it, Million Dollar Baby? It's Oscar nominated in several categories. In not the least of which, of course, is Best Picture. I think he also gets Best Director nomination as well. As time permits here, we'll hear from Johnny Erickson Tada on one of the moral issues raised by that very popular and award-winning movie, Million Dollar Baby. It has to do, I believe, with assisted suicide and euthanasia from the direction of Clint Eastwood and what is proving to be a very popular movie. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Especially our black listeners, the Black Contract with America on Moral Values. Had you heard of it? Now that you have heard of it, what do you make of it? Is there something missing there that you think ought to be included in and among those 6 points that were listed? By the way, family reconstruction, wealth creation, education reform, African relief for the Sudan, prison reform, and healthcare reform. Is something missing there from that. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Okay, to Million Dollar Baby, Johnny Erickson Tata calls the movie itself, Million Dollar Baby, evil.
To help a quadriplegic kill herself is not an expression of love, although that is what is underscored in the film. No, to help a quadriplegic kill herself is a demonstration of contempt and fear. And I believe it's dangerous because it reinforces the moviegoer's fundamental fears of disability.
We talked recently with Brian Gadawa when we were going through the Oscar nominations, and he had mentioned he wasn't going to give away the ending of Million Dollar Baby, but he had watched it, and he said the worldview therein is bone-chilling. Now I know what he's talking about. The young lady who is the prize fighter in the movie, Clint Eastwood is the coach, ends up being quadriplegic. Now, Johnny Erickson Tata is herself quadriplegic. You will remember her famous story, often retold. She's been a guest on this program. To help a quadriplegic kill oneself is not loving, but the message of the movie is that is the most compassionate thing to do. Now, Johnny Erickson Tata also says that Million Dollar Baby sends a frightening message to her and to other disabled people.
It concerns me deeply that now we live in a culture which capitalizes on that depression and reinforces to people like myself that, quote, you're better off dead than disabled. That's unfortunate. That's sad. That is evil.
I can only imagine what it must be like from a wheelchair to get this message from a movie. That, oh, while you were up and fit and able to throw punches and make money for your manager and be a great prize fighter, the most compassionate thing to do is to stand behind you and help you overcome your physical obstacles and get back in the ring. But now that you're a quadriplegic, the best thing and most compassionate thing to do is to do away with you. I can only imagine what that sounds like from the vantage point of a wheelchair. Tata says that euthanasia is nothing short of murder. It is not mercy killing.
I am so frustrated that our culture continues to promote the premise that if you love somebody, you're free to kill them, all in the name of compassion. That is detestable and hateful.
Now, I want you to consider for a moment, we have the words right there of a quadriplegic herself. I've seen her. She gets around just fine, but on wheels. She has, Johnny Erickson Tata, has contributed quite a bit to not only the cultural conversation and to people who are disabled like she is, but also to the Christian church. Very level-headed in her thinking about the Christian church. And where would she be had her parents said at one point, or had they been able to legally at some point, say, look, she's a young girl, whole life before her, and now that life's hopes have been dashed to pieces, and maybe there was a point at which she herself even wanted to die. What if her parents had indulged her desires? When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Dr. James Hitchcock. The Vatican has a new statement on marriage annulments. Why is this called for? Why is it necessary? And also, should the Pope step down? We'll answer those questions with Dr. Hitchcock right after this.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, etc.
The entire Old Testament book of Joshua is built upon a promise that God made in the book of Genesis to Abraham to give his descendants the promised land. But is there more to this promise and to the book of Joshua than simply the land of Israel? How should we rightly understand the book of Joshua in light of Jesus Christ? Our Issues, etc. book of the month for February is the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. The book is $42.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for the Issues, etc. book of the month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. It's the Concordia Commentary on Joshua, the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February.
Insects. Now, were they on Noah's Ark?
Answers with Ken Ham, one of the authors of the Answers book. Well, Ken, we know that Noah took two of every kind of land animal and seven of some on board his ark, but did that also include insects?
Well, you know, we don't doubt that some insects may indeed have ridden on the ark, but if they did, they would have been stowaways. You see, the real question is whether or not insects were among the living creatures that God said had to be on the ark. Were they creatures with a life spirit called a nephesh and were thus brought on board? You know, there are differences of opinion amongst Bible scholars as to exactly which creatures are covered in the Genesis 6 list that went on the ark. But most conservative scholars seem to regard the invertebrates, those without a backbone, which include insects, as not being among them. So if God didn't require Noah to take insects aboard the ark, wouldn't they have perished in the flood? Well, according to Genesis 7, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the Spirit of life died. But insects don't breathe through nostrils. Insects could have survived the flood by being on floating rafts of vegetation or other materials. They could have been preserved as adults, eggs, larvae, or pupae. So were insects on the ark? Well, the best answer, according to Genesis, is that they weren't required to be, but they could have been there by accident.
Why would a loving God allow so much death and suffering in this world, even at the time of Noah? Read Ken Ham's answer when you go to AnswersRadio.com. AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Frequently in the movies, clergy are portrayed as corrupt or dishonest. Christian laypeople, especially conservative ones, are often viewed as laughable simpletons who are nice enough but don't really know what is going on. Or they are fanatics and dangerous zealots who kill and destroy, supposedly in the name of Christ. If you are watching a movie with your child and such a theme appears, use that as a precious teaching opportunity. Christ loved us enough to die for us. He also loves us enough to provide pastors and fellow Christians for our mutual support and encouragement. Our Christian faith is a precious gift from God, earned for us by Jesus. Do not let the media lead your children into thinking our faith is to be ridiculed or mocked. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute at cmli.org.
Next time on the Bible study, we begin the book of Joshua with our look at chapter 1. In chapter 1, the Lord himself gives Joshua instructions and commands, and we'll talk about it with Pastor Bill Whedon of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel. Joshua 1, up next time on the Bible study. Heard weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
If you go to our website, issuesetc.org, you'll find all sorts of important things there about how to contact us and whatnot. You'll find our Issues Etc. book of the month. If you keep scrolling down right there on the homepage, you'll also see a logo for Christ Academy 2005. In fact, do it now. Go there when you get home and click on the information link next to the logo for Christ Academy 2005. It's a 2-week residential program. Why would you be interested? Well, you certainly know a young man or two, maybe a son, a grandson, maybe someone in your congregation, who you have looked at and said, you know, this guy might someday make a good pastor. You don't know for sure, but there's one way to help him find out, and that is to help him go to Christ Academy 2005. It's a 2-week summer residential program for high school-aged men on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. He will get to go to class. He'll get to go to chapel. He will spend 2 weeks there with other men his age who are also contemplating the pastoral ministry. The faculty will be teaching him. They won't be shuffling him off to some assistant professor someplace. He'll interact with the seminary students who are already there and get a real taste of what seminary life is like and what study for the pastoral ministry is like. By the way, we heard from Larry Rast the other day that this isn't a pared-down high school version of seminary classes. They get it full bore. They get to see what it's all about. Not only whet their appetite, but give them an idea of what may lie ahead for them if they're headed for the seminary. Christ Academy 2005. Find out more about it at our website or call them toll-free, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155. Our website address again, it's right there on the homepage as you scroll down, issuesetc.org, Christ Academy 2005. Tomorrow on the program, the Middle East peace process. The headline of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch reads, "Ceasefire, but will it last?" A picture of the Palestinian and the Israeli leader reaching across a table to shake hands and to agree on a total ceasefire. The terms of this are all hostilities everywhere ceasing on both sides. Will it last? We'll talk about the implications of a Middle East peace process with Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine tomorrow on the program. We'll also discuss Christian education in the inner city with Paul Miller, principal at Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis. That's tomorrow on Issues, Etc. Dr. James Hitchcock is our guest. He joins us to talk about a new Vatican statement on annulments. That caught my ear. Also, something we've been talking about a little bit recently on the program, and that is, should the Pope step down, given his poor state of health? But first, I'd like his opinion and his thoughts on what's been the news most lately. Today, Tim Townsend of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch writes under the headline, Burke to penalize St. Stan board members, the story about St. Stanislaus Kostka Catholic Church in the city. Dr. Hitchcock, welcome back.
Thank you very much. I always enjoy being here.
Well, what are your thoughts on the whole dispute between the St. Louis Archdiocese and St. Stanislaus?
Well, I think strictly speaking, the Archbishop's position is an unassailable one. That is, in the Catholic system of things, we're not a Congregationalist church, and individual parishes cannot, under church law, own their own property and operate independently of the diocese. So I think the Archbishop's here on perfectly solid ground. I think there are historical reasons why that situation developed. There's a group called the Polish National Church, which broke away from Catholic Church sometime 100 years or more ago. And according to some plausible accounts, St. Stanislaus got title to its own property sort of as an inducement for them not to join the Polish National Church. It's also true, although I think no one wants to say this publicly, in 1891 when Archbishop Peter R. Kenrick of St. Louis approved that arrangement, he was actually pretty senile. I think the Archbishop is clearly within his rights here.
And how are we to rightly understand, hopefully tomorrow we'll be talking with representatives from both sides of this issue, if possible, but how are we to rightly understand what's being called by some a mini-excommunication on the part of the bishop toward the board members of St. Stan's? And on the other, look, this is just being called
An interdict.
An interdict. Can you explain both of those perspectives?
Well, I'll tell you the truth, I'm somewhat confused about those terms myself. Historically, what I understood by an interdict is worse than an excommunication in that it would be imposed on a whole group. So a whole city would be placed under an interdict, which would be tantamount to excommunicating everybody in that city, whereas an excommunication would be directed against individuals. I presume the term interdict is being used here because it is a collection of, what is it, five or six people. As far as I know, it has the same effect as excommunication, but you probably need someone else who could clarify that for you.
The other issues are almost as pressing here, and this is with the rising numbers of annulments being requested from the churches, from the bishops, and from the Vatican, there appears to be some rethinking of the annulment policy. What's going on with this new Vatican statement on annulments?
Well, it obviously is calling for stricter standards. I think a lot of cynicism has arisen both among Catholics and non-Catholics in the last 35 years or so, saying, well, we claim we don't allow divorce, but we just call it an annulment. Now, the idea of an annulment, of course, is to say, well, it never really was a marriage to begin with, and it's clear enough in certain cases, for example, if there was coercion involved when the two people got married. But where they have tremendously expanded the number of annulments is by looking at what is often called the psychological norms, and that is to say, well, this person or these people were not really capable of making a marital commitment when they were married, and so it's not really a marriage. Now, you can see that that's true in some cases, a mentally deficient person or something like that, but I think a lot of people, Catholics who, well, other people too, who know individuals who have received annulments, and you're sort of scratching your head and saying, well, I don't understand this. You know, they seem perfectly capable of making a commitment. They were married 25 years. They had three children. They all seem to be very happy. You know, what's this all about? So that's what the Vatican seems to be concerned about.
So an annulment, so that we don't misunderstand, is in fact, because marriage is considered a sacramental act by the Roman Church, it is essentially a theological judgment that the sacramental act was invalid when first performed.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. So strictly speaking, the Church cannot dissolve a marriage, but it can say that there was not a marriage to begin with.
Historically, what have been valid reasons for granting an annulment, and where has that migrated now?
Well, it would be, again, coercion would be obviously one. Misidentification, you know, someone gets married claiming to be someone different than he truly is. Absence of the ability to make a commitment, as I said, you know, someone who's mentally deficient or who's emotionally upset to the point where they can't really make a commitment. Impotency. It will annul a marriage if it turns out that the husband is impotent, since marriage is oriented towards the procreation of children. Lack of intention to have children has been considered grounds for an annulment. If one or more of the parties entering into it have, you're supposed to promise at the wedding that you will have children, and if one or more of the parties have closed their mind to that, that could be considered then a basis for an annulment.
According to the news, the pontiff has decided to revamp the guidelines, so to speak, on annulments. What is expected here, then?
I'm not quite sure how that's going to work in practice. It was a striking figure. 80% of all the applications, apparently, last year were approved. One wonders who are the poor people that couldn't get theirs approved. And then, secondly, a very disproportionate number, well over half, are granted in the United States. Now, you sometimes hear it said, well, A, in a lot of places, a lot of other cultures, divorce is not very common, so therefore you don't have as many people asking for annulments. Or even you say, well, look at Europe, divorce is common, but people don't even bother to look for an annulment. They just go ahead anyway, get married outside the church. But for whatever reason, the U.S. leads the world in this, and so it's going to be particularly crucial in the U.S. I presume that, not being a canon lawyer and not having seen the rules, I presume that it's going to say, look, you've got to be a lot stricter about this. These cases, and I'm not quite sure under what circumstances, many of them then are appealed to Rome, and then it's quite possible that a tribunal in Rome can overturn the decision of a tribunal in another country.
You mentioned before that in Europe, people don't even seek the annulment. They just get the civil divorce and kind of forget the counsel of the church in this regard. Is that a likely outcome if the standards are tightened, especially, you know, worldwide, but especially in the American context, that American Catholics will say, well, phooey, I want to end this thing. I'm going to get a divorce and be done, and I'm not going to consult the church on the matter.
I think that is very likely to happen to some extent. I think it already does to some extent because, you know, the Catholic membership, you might say, in the United States, even when you start analyzing it, you know, how many people are truly active, how many people accept the teachings of the church. There's a large number who call themselves Catholic but have a pretty loose relationship to the institution. I get the impression, I mean, it's just an impression, that these are often people who don't really care much, you know, whether the church gives them an annulment or not. But the advantage of having an annulment is then if they get remarried, they can have another church wedding, and that's what they want. So some of them, I think, will then start going off and getting remarried somewhere else, which goes on already anyway.
On the local level, let's say in the St. Louis Archdiocese, if someone was trying to procure an annulment, let's say for the sake of argument, it's a legitimate annulment that they want to procure. There's mm-hmm. some sort of deception at the prior to the marriage or something. To whom would they go? Did they go to the archbishop or to someone else to get this initial judgment?
Not directly to the archbishop. There's what they call a tribunal, which handles these cases. And the priest who's the head of it, I believe, is now called the judicial vicar. The offices, I think, are down on Lindell Boulevard in the Chancery office. But I think I also have the impression, I'm not certain about this, that you kind of have to start with your parish priest and have him originate the process.
So it's initially a pastoral issue in any case.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
Well, this all raises the question, coming back to the Vatican, of course, and the Pope's action on annulments raises the question of the Pope himself. He's been down with the flu, as far as I know, still in the hospital, but news reports say he is on the mend. How big of an issue is the Pope's health at this point?
Well, it's really hard to say because, of course, plausible reports of his ill health have been going on for a couple of decades. Probably back to the time that he was shot, and that there have been ups and downs, and he looks bad and he looks better. He seems to be one of those people who, even though he suffers from chronic ill health, has more endurance than a lot of people in good health who drop dead someday. The question, of course, is can he continue to function? There's the perennial speculation: would he step down? The Vatican has studiously refused to comment on that issue. It seems to me to be not beyond possibility that he would. But there's a kind of a catch-22 here, and that is if a pope were truly incapacitated, would he have the consciousness to actually tender his resignation? And I don't think anybody else is, you know, there's no way that he can be resigned if he didn't voluntarily do it himself.
Is there an historical precedent for a pope resigning or stepping down?
There are a few. They're quite remote. There's one in the early centuries where a pope was being sent off by the Roman persecutors to the salt mines, and he knew he was never coming back, so he resigned, and another successor. There's an unfortunate incident in the early 14th century or late 13th century that where a pope who seemingly thought he was in over his head resigned, and then he subsequently fell to his death, and there was a certain amount of mystery about it. And that incident, which is the last one that occurred, is, I suppose, to some extent has seared itself on people's minds. You know, the resignation of a pope is not a good idea.
And is there, you were talking about the eventuality or the possibility of incapacitation, then of course the pope may be incapable of deciding or expressing a decision
right.
to resign. What would actually happen then if we have a pope, say, living, perhaps through his Parkinson's, incapacitated to the point where his wishes can't be determined? What would actually happen at that point for the rest of his life?
It's a very troublesome question. I guess in theory it would be like during the period when there is no pope, that is, between elections, when the church goes on running, and I think the cardinal who's called the Secretary of State has responsibility for keeping it running along with the other administrators in the Vatican. But according to canon law, you know, you're supposed to just basically keep it on maintenance. No major decisions are to be made. No major appointments are supposed to be made. Presumably that would be what would happen in the case of an incapacitated pope, but if he remained incapacitated for a very long time, that would really create a very unfortunate situation.
Now, this Pope John Paul II has appointed about 85% of the College of Cardinals, that group that would vote in his successor. He's outlived many of his potential successors just
That's
because
true.
Of his long tenure.
He's Who's... outlived any three or four people that I have heard mentioned as successors. In fact, of the active cardinals, those over the age of 80, I believe, can't vote. And I think of the ones who are able to vote by virtue of their age, he's appointed practically all of them. You know, he has now one of the longest pontificates in the history of the church. There's plausible speculation that the next time around they're not going to elect a young man of 58 as he was when he was elected. But of course, that's an interesting thing too. When John 23rd was elected, he was 77, And people said, well, this is just a caretaker. You know, he's going to stay there for a few years. And, well, of course, he proved to be one of the most significant popes in the history of the church. So electing an older man doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a tired administration.
You rightly predicted on this very program, when we were talking about the departure of Archbishop Regali, that Raymond Burke would be the next head of the St. Louis Archdiocese.
Mm-hmm.
That prediction came true. So who's going to be the next pope?
If I pick one name right now, I'll say Cardinal Angelo Scola of Venice. But I think there's a great question here. Are they going to return back to the custom of an Italian pope, or having moved out of Italy, are they going to keep on moving? The name of Cardinal Norberto Rivera of Mexico City is mentioned. The name of Cardinal Juan Sandoval Iniguez of Guadalajara, Mexico, is mentioned. A man whom I personally know and I think would be excellent would be Cardinal George Pell of Sydney, Australia. If I had to settle on one guess at this point, I'd say Cardinal Angelo Scola of Venice.
No Americans on the list, I note.
I don't think there will ever be an American pope, at least not for many years, because I think it would raise this whole business, you know, well, you're the most powerful nation in the world, and here you are, now you control the Catholic Church as well. If there were going to be an American pope, I think it would be Cardinal Francis George of Chicago, but don't put your money on an American pope.
Given the fact that he has appointed almost all of those who would vote for his successor, how likely is it that the next pope, whoever they may be, wherever they may come from, will, in effect, be a continuation of John Paul's pontificate?
Well, I think that's probably the case, but I think John Paul's pontificate is more complex than is often realized. He's perceived, particularly by his critics, as being extremely conservative. In some respects, that's true. In other respects, it's not true. And I would also say that on the whole, he's been a relatively permissive pope. He's not been a great disciplinarian. And although you hear it said, oh, he's cloned himself in the College of Cardinals, there's quite a variety within the College of Cardinals. So in continuation of the policies of John Paul II, that isn't as clear-cut what that means. As some people may think.
Would it be unprecedented for John Paul before his death or even the possibility of his stepping down to actually express a preference about a successor? Would that be bad form?
Yes. It would certainly not be done publicly. My doubt is it would even be done privately. If it were done, I think it would be done because it was somebody he was trying to undermine, because it's the sort of thing I believe that would rub a lot of the cardinals the wrong way, that the idea that the pope was trying to name his successor, that would probably count against the man in question.
And on the issue of stepping down, has John Paul made any expression that would indicate what his intentions are at the present?
Not to my knowledge that he said anything on that question.
So coming back to something that we were discussing at the very beginning, just to get ourselves clear with the St. Stan's question, you said that Archbishop Burke's position of basically saying the property belongs to the diocese is a rock-solid position in terms of canon law. What's going to have to happen before that actually becomes a reality?
I don't know. What if the interdict is issued with regard to the board? The last I saw in the Post-Dispatch, various members of the board were saying, I don't care. I'll do what I want. Now, they can't have Mass or the sacraments at the church, so it would be a question then of owning the property, but what would you do with it? Would they then, in fact, make contact with some group that has split off, such as the Polish National Church? Perhaps. But otherwise, they have a church but have no use for it. It's fairly clear that the Archbishop has thought about it now for quite a long time and has said he's not going to change his position. So unless the board changes its position, I don't think anything's going to happen.
Will it stay within the church, or could it move over into the civil courts at all?
It would be a very knotty issue, because the general position of the civil courts is, when there's a dispute of this kind over property, the civil courts enforce the rules of a particular church. So, for example, in the Episcopal Church, if a parish decides to break, they leave and go away, they almost never get to keep their property, because the courts say, well, look, in the Episcopal Church, it says you can't do that. Since in this case, they have got apparently a signed, sealed, and delivered agreement from 1891. Would that supersede the other rule? I think it would be really quite an interesting case.
And Burke seems to, at least early here in his archbishopric, be quite willing to stand toe-to-toe with opponents and even take up thorny issues like this that don't necessarily get him the best press. What does that tell you about Archbishop Burke?
Well, I do think he's a man of principle. I know him slightly, and I think he's really a very kind man, a very, very warm man. I think his public image of him as a kind of a martinet is incorrect, but he's very definitely a man of principle, and I would say he's a man of courage. He's hired someone to represent him in the public sphere, someone with media experience, and I suppose there's some use to that. But in the end, I think the issues are perceived very clearly. This is not a case of an image problem or misunderstanding. There are real issues of principle at stake here, and the Archbishop has taken his stand.
Dr. James Hitchcock is professor of history at St. Louis University. Dr. Hitchcock, as usual, it's always a pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to future conversations.
Thank you. I do, too.
Dr. James Hitchcock, professor of history at St. Louis University, talking about these three issues, the State Sands story that continues to unfold, the new Vatican statement on annulments, and the question of whether or not the Pope should resign. Doesn't look like the Pope is going to be going anyplace anytime soon, so the story will continue. Tomorrow on the program, what will we be discussing tomorrow on the program? Let's see. We're going to be talking about the Middle East situation, and Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine will be our guest. The ceasefire, in many ways unprecedented. We are turning a new page. We're back on the roadmap to peace. Is that necessarily good news? We'll also talk about Christian education in the inner city with Paul Miller of Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.